Blog Talk Radio.
This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is the TS Radio Network. Our show tonight is the USDA Hour, and it is co-hosted with Lawrence Lucas. Our show is brought to you in coordination with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblower Summit, taking place at the end of July every year in Washington, D.C. And with that, Lawrence, how you doing?
Good afternoon, and thanks for having all of us on tonight.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to do it. Tonight, our guests are Nate Rosenberg and Bryce Stuckey, and they have done a documentary, and it's on farming. And we talked to them here a few months back about their documentary and their encounter with the USDA. So, guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bryce, what we'd like to do is We're going to have a conversation tonight in lieu of an interview. So we want to start off with you telling the listening public about what each one of you all have done, how you all came together, number one, and how did your education and your professional background take you to the stage that you're in now with writing some of the most dynamic stories and doing some of the most dynamic and credible research dealing with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the wide range of discrimination, both against farmers, which you all have done an excellent job peeling out information from the census, as well as being able to have the kind of credibility where people would be willing to talk to you both in and outside of government. So I would like to start this conversation by having each one of you all to kind of give us your background and talk about how you came together as one to do this incredible research and write these incredible stories.
Okay. Thank you. Nate, do you want to go first or should I go first?
Sure, yeah. Why don't I start with talking about my background, and then Bryce can talk about his and how we met and started working issues together. So I'm an attorney and sometimes law professor, and I graduated from law school almost 10 years ago now. And while I was in law school, I was working on issues in the South, where I was working with small farmers who wanted to sell to local schools. And then after I graduated from law school, I continued that work. I moved to Mississippi, where I lived for a couple of years. And a lot of the small farmers I worked with were Black farmers. And before I moved to Mississippi, I knew nothing about the history of Black farming or its relationship to Black wealth and the civil rights movement, how Black farmers played such a crucial role in civil rights. But as I started to work with and get to know these farmers, I started to learn about their history and also to learn about the USDA's ongoing discrimination against Black farmers. And I moved away from Mississippi in 2014. And that was the same year that the Census of Agriculture came out. It comes out every 5 years. And the Census of Agriculture said that there was an increase in Black farming. And, you know, anyone who was familiar with the Black farming communities in the South, I think would know that just wasn't accurate. And so I started to look at the data to try to understand what was happening, and that's where Bryce came in.
Yes. So, Nate, I have a mutual friend who connected us, and I think initially Nate. So I had always kind of been interested in the history of the civil rights movement, and I had interned at a magazine and written articles for them, mostly about education and discrimination against Black students. And so I kind of had some published articles and an interest, you know, in reporting on discrimination. And the thing is, with reporting, I also, as Nate can tell you, I like to go usually than the mainstream coverage. So I think when our friend connected us, it sort of appealed to me that Nate had like a story that countered the mainstream narrative, although it took me a really long time to accept it, and because what he was telling me was so at odds with what I thought was happening in agriculture, and some of the abuses I learned about were so extreme and so brazen that it was hard for me to believe that they really happened. At first Nate, and that's like been ongoing, and I'm sure we'll hear about new stuff that will take me a second to accept, but I'm ready to accept a lot now. But anyway, Nate called. He asked me for help with the analyze the census, and then he found my clips, and we decided to start pitching some articles, and then we wrote a law review article together, and the New Food Economy published it, and it was kind of about the history of agriculture, and it had a section about, well, kind of a theme, discrimination against Black farmers. So anyway, we had an outlet that wanted to publish stuff by us, and then Nate had kind of been, he had all these ideas about what he wanted to say about USDA, and so he did like an enormous amount of reporting and research, and then we worked together to turn that into that big article that we did for them that we finally published a couple weeks ago.
What were the titles of those two articles and the dates that they were published? The one or two.
So the
The
biggest one was published on June 26th of this year, and it's called How USDA Distorted Data to Conceal Decades of Discrimination Against Black Farmers. And that one is very long. It's designed to be comprehensive in scope. And then we had a shorter one that was about disparities in payments through the tariff bailout payments. And that one was published on July 29th, and it was called USDA Gave Almost 100% of Trump's Trade War Bailout to White Farmers. And I think the title does a good job of telling you what it's about.
Tell our listening public what publications or organizations publish each one of those articles.
Both can be found, in the New Food Economy. Although the second one, the shorter one about the trade war bailout payments, that was originally published by a consortium of law schools called the Farm Bill Law Enterprise.
Okay, I've got a question here already from a listener that just shot me here on Facebook, and they asked about non-positive code and title. They're asking about, are you aware of that? And I'm sure you are with a law background. And what I know about that is, and I know what they're going to hear, agriculture is non-positive code and title. The federal government is not supposed to be involved in agriculture. They can be involved in commerce between the states, but not within the state. Of course, we've bypassed all of that. through contracting with federal agencies, the USDA coming into your state and implementing their business plan. But anyway, with that in mind, you talked about the agricultural census. When that first came out, it was called a survey, and everybody immediately pitched that in the trash can. And I've advised people since then, if they get a agricultural census, to do the same. You're under no – they cannot compel you to fill that out. And what they're what this is all leading towards is this national animal identification crap, and which will establish national herds and flocks as owned by the USDA, and you become the operator or manager but not the actual owner of, and they can sell it, of course, without reserve any notice to you. And so, I mean, there's all this whole undercurrent running behind this whole thing. Years ago, when I first got involved with any issues with the USDA, it was in the southeastern states, the Carolinas, Georgia, down through there, Alabama, Mississippi, and it had to do with milk at that time. We had a glut of milk in the western states, but supposedly there was a shortage on the eastern seaboard. So they would let milk be ferried in from China, but they would not let the western ranchers, dairy farmers, ship their milk to the East Coast. And then we found out that Georgia Land Grant University was involved. And let's take the state of Georgia at that time, had over 800 independently owned dairy farms. Within 2 years, there were less than 200 of them left. And about 370 of those were owned by black farmers. And all of that, what their intention was, to make all milk production in the United States across those five states and end it everywhere else. And it was going to be taken over by New Zealand Agritech, if I remember correctly. And that was all put in place by the USDA, but they were wiping out these farmers. What I don't understand here is, are they trying to, from what you've seen and what you've worked on, are they trying to end agricultural here except by that of foreign or global corporations? Is this just simply targeted at black farmers and Hispanic women farmers, or is it is across the board ending independent and family farming?
Well, I would say, you know, there's not any sort of – there's no evidence of any sort of grand plan as far as I know, but I think there's – overwhelming evidence that the Department of Agriculture is biased against smaller scale enterprises, smaller scale farms.
Yes.
And so I think there's lots of things going on. I do think that black farmers in particular are targeted, but it's not a question of, you know, are they targeting black farmers or small farmers? They're treated in different ways, and there's a bias against small-scale farmers, and there's also often a bias against black farmers.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and when you were dealing with the USDA in all of this for this documentary, and I'm sure you had contact with them, how receptive were they to you? I always wonder how bad it, my own encounters with federal agencies and politicians and all that is. They're real nice in your face, but they'll lie to you in a heartbeat. And when you catch them in a lie and you tell them you just told me a lie, which I'm known to do, and don't give me a phone number because I'll call it. They'll just turn around and tell you another one. But how receptive were they to you, and or did they put up any roadblocks trying to stop you from getting information?
Yeah, so both Bryce and I mostly just we write academic articles and we write for online publications. So thankfully we don't have to go out there and videotape people, because it would be very hard to get USDA officials in front of a camera. But we've done a number of interviews and as soon as we did and there were the first article, the longer one, we caught, I think it's pretty clear, and if you read the story, I think it comes across. We caught both the former Secretary of Agriculture and the former Civil Rights Director under that secretary, under Secretary Vilsack. We caught both of them in, at best, telling non-truths or making errors.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, they weren't used to being challenged on their civil rights record. And
right.
I think when they initially talked to us, they expected it to be a soft interview.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
I think you're right.
Yeah, you can.
Vilsack, I'm familiar with him. Oh, go ahead. You go ahead and talk. I don't need to.
Well, I was just going to say, so Nate does, you know, but I listen to all of the interviews he did. And
yeah.
Can you hear me?
Is someone on speakerphone? If
I'm
you
on
are, could you shut it down, please? Yeah, because we're getting a reverb off of it.
Oh, well, I don't, well, I'm on, I've got headphones in, so it's probably somebody else.
Okay. Okay.
But,
go ahead.
Is it still happening?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so, anyway, just listening to the interviews, you know, you can tell that, you know, I just wanted to second what Nate said. You can tell they are taken aback when they get a question that
mm-hmm.
kind of challenges their narrative about what happened when they were in office. And yeah,
yes.
I don't think
they're
used to it. And I think that's part of why it was able to go on for so long. I think that's a big part of it. So.
Well, and with mainstream media, if they interview them, they basically just go along with whatever they say. There's no real interview taking place there. I mean, I think that's what's hit the public about mainstream media. It's just, it's not worth listening to. So I'm sure being interviewed by someone like you that honestly was trying to get information and figure things out probably threw them for a loop. You know, having been out there in D.C., I'm going to tell you guys, and I've said this publicly more than once, I have never met a bigger group of the more disingenuous, pretentious people gathered together in one spot in my life as I did with my encounters with Congress.
I thought you were
going to
say with D.C. in general.
Yeah, that's
well,
what I thought, too.
Well, you know, the thing is, when you're out in the public, everybody was quite friendly. I was surprised by that. And talked and just very social, you know. But it's when you got into these halls of grandeur that they move around in, it was just the whole attitude of people was just that somehow – they were royalty. They were just above. I had an encounter with one senator who found me objectionable, having listened to my radio shows. I have no idea why I'm such a nice person. But anyway, and he cocked off at me and comped an attitude and was talking to me. And he called me by my first name, which I really don't have any problem with. But so when I responded to him, I called him by his first name. And he said, the proper way to address me is Senator. And I said, well, if we're going to use fictitious titles, I said, you can call me Your Majesty. And he kind of looked at me. He said, I want you to remember you're talking to a sitting U.S. Senator. And I said, well, good. I said, we're establishing hierarchy here. I said, that means you work for me. I don't work for you. And I said, so when you speak to me, I'd appreciate it if you adopted a little more subordinate attitude. And, of course, that didn't fly too good. I thought I was going to get thrown out of the building. But you just cannot let these people talk down to you. They forget that they're supposed to be public servants. And they forget that they're where they are for that reason, to serve the public. What happens to these people once they get into office or they get a cabinet or agency position? What happens in their minds to the people around them, I want to know. Because it's like we're dealing literally with a foreign government that hates us. And
I want to add to that, Marty. One of the things that I would like to discuss in answering that question, what about the tone of not only the information and how the information was coming out of USDA. But what about the tone as it relates to how the media were, in fact, taking the information that was pumped out of these public relations machines using taxpayers' dollars. What did you notice about the tone and the coverage from your standpoint and what you were seeing and while you were doing your research?
So, Nate, do you want to take that, or should I talk, or what do you want?
Go for it.
I think that one of the things that was really striking to me was, so I mentioned when Nate first was telling me, slowly unraveling all of the deceit, you know, I was kind of shocked by how badly the media had the story wrong, although I was familiar with that phenomena. I mean, I think that happens in almost every, field of journalism, is the mainstream narrative sometimes often has nothing to do with reality at all. I think under the Vilsack administration at USDA, the press pretty much went with whatever the USDA public relations people said. And I think that part of that is, I think the press was sympathetic and they wanted the administration to succeed. And at the same time, the administration knew how to say all the right things to get the press on their side. But of course, farmers were not being listened to. And, you know, another thing that we talk about in the article is this intense skepticism and hostility that the press showed toward black farmers. So we have a section on the Pigford settlement, and we talk about how the New York Times covered allegations of fraud in Pigford. And if you read that article now, the New York Times article, which is several years old, it's just shocking the level of suspicion and hostility that the reporter has for, black farmers who she discusses in the article. And me and Nate Nate, I think, probably pointed this out to me, but we've talked about just the world of difference in how the press now covers farmers who are getting bailouts. There's many, many articles that are very sympathetic to the farmers. And that's not to say that, there aren't many farmers having a hard time right now. It's just that there were a lot of black farmers having a hard time then, and they got no sympathy, basically. Mm-hmm. So,
I'm sorry, please go ahead. Please go ahead.
That was one thing that really jumped out at me, and I think people would find genuinely surprising or shocking if they went back and read that article, which is really not that old. But we link to it and discuss it.
Well, there was an article that came out, in fact, two of them in Yes Magazine, and it was supposedly about the black farmer issue, and this was just here this last year. And you read through this thing, and it was obviously put together by USDA. It was just a screaming load of crap. And we went after them about it. They came out with a second article, and they talked about how black farmers, the number of black farmers was increasing in the second article, and they were showing pictures of people growing vegetables in pots, and what it turned out was gardening, in-city gardening, that people were doing to raise vegetables and stuff. That isn't farming. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think part of what happened there is I don't know if these are the articles you're referring to, but a black farmer and advocate named Leah Penniman writes for Yes Magazine sometimes, and she does her journalism is really great, and she does an excellent job of talking about what's happening with black farmers. But part of the problem is that there's a few different things going on. There are, there's a movement in urban areas and rural areas that are nearby large cities in the north where there's a growing number of brown and black young people who want to farm, and that's a real phenomenon, and I think those are real farmers, and it's important to understand them as such. But also, you know, Bryce has an amazing background in statistics, and I've been, you know, learning as much as I can, and we spent just an absurd amount of time understanding how the Census of Agriculture works and the data behind it. And so I think with publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post, who got this story wrong, that's on them as well. But I also understand that there are a lot of people who are writing pieces in their or because they see it as part of their advocacy and as their calling, who really care about these issues, and they trusted the census data, and I understand why they trusted it. And I think it's the job of large public of national outlets to look more critically at those data.
Right. I think that
they're not going to. They're going to take what's handed to them because that's what they get paid to do. Those are not like investigators and reporters like the two of you are. They're not real journalists. These are paid actors that are reading a script. And they couldn't tell you what's really going on with anything, quite honestly, the majority of them. So, you know, like I say, going to mainstream media and thinking you're going to actually hear what took place in any instance is pretty slim to none. But I wanted to ask you also, as you wrote these articles, did you encounter any problems with getting them published?
I would say no, not really. I mean, we had the normal kind of back and forth with the editors, but I think when we talked it out, when we talked our issues out, you know, they kind of understood. And we, I mean, the thing is that we have, you know, an immense amount of just, I mean, a huge, huge amount of research, like statistical research, and then Nate has got an enormous amount of data, and we have so many transcripts and audio, you know, from the interviews. There's just a overwhelming huge amount of evidence, and I think that I would think that you know, helps convince the editor, and they trusted us too because we've done other pieces for them. So I would say that we didn't.
Yeah.
Really,
well,
yeah.
Yeah. I wanted
well,
to say that.
Unless
the
you want to talk about
economy,
538, but yeah.
Yeah, sure. So the new food economy has been absolutely great and supportive, and I think very interested in stories that don't follow conventional wisdom. And,
right.
You know, not only our pieces, they've published a lot of, they punch way above their weight. They're a nonprofit organization that does a lot of interesting investigative journalism about food and the food system. But that said, you know, a lot of it, we had wonderful editors there, and a lot of it has to do with editors and how they perceive the world. Again, it's not, you know, it's not that the publisher is telling these publications you can't publish anything negative about USDA or Vilsack, but a lot of the editors come from a similar class, they go to similar Ivy League schools, and they tend to see the way and they tend to see the world from the perspective of a relatively privileged, generally white, wealthy person. And I think that shows in the articles they choose and what they decide to focus on.
Right.
And as Bryce was referring to, you know, we originally had a really great editor at 538 who was interested in these stories. She left. Another editor came in. He hated it immediately. He said we were just attacking the Obama administration. And you know, we had, as Bryce said, just this enormous amount of evidence, We interviewed a large number of people, but he was just, from the very moment, he had no interest in learning about the issue. Because one, it was just about farmers, and it was clear from his tone that he didn't care, that farmers were just kind of like these boring people in the middle of nowhere. And two, it went against his, how he viewed the world, I think. You know, he said, this just looks to me like an attack on the Obama administration, which it wasn't. You know, we were talking about a really important substantive issue.
And it's gone on a lot longer, you know, than the Obama administration. It wasn't, you know, I think what Nate's saying is that he perceived it as like a gratuitous attack, you know, an unfair attack, which was not the point at all, you know, totally beside the point. I mean, you did what you did, you know, the people in power at the time did what they did. It's not a crime to document it. It's not an attack. People have to be allowed to document it. I mean, it's not right to live in a democracy. I mean, that's what's so frustrating sometimes about this is these farmers, you know this stuff. And I'm sure, you know, like Lloyd Wright, a former director of the Civil Rights Office and a farmer himself, like he went on the record with us, you know. And I'm sure if there'd been other reporters who cared enough and, you know, showed that they knew the issue, he would go on the record with them too. Or, you know, perhaps they could offer him a short essay or something in their outlet, but that never happens. I mean, that almost never happens.
Right.
You know, people
well,
with
you know,
access.
I think that's...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say people with access, like me and Nate, you know, we try to use it to get like Lloyd's message and other people's message out there who wouldn't otherwise be offered the opportunity. And I mean, I think that's wrong, you know, that they don't get the chance. So anyway, getting back to 538, you know, at first our main pitch to them was about the census, because they are like a statistical analysis website. And we thought we had a perfect fit for them because this was about how you know, the press had interpreted this study wrong. Furthermore, it kind of seemed like the department had not been, you know, nearly as forthcoming as other agencies. And we thought that was right up their alley. And I remember the editor said something to the effect of, well, if I was in Tom Vilsack's shoes, I would have done the same thing. And I said,
oh.
I mean, that was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of justification is that? I mean, I think he didn't get it. I really do. I think he didn't.
Right.
I don't think he understood how serious a problem this was. But still, I mean, that is kind of sums it up, I think, kind of the problems you deal with sometimes.
With this agricultural survey, what I'm trying to figure out is this: with the corporate farming that has taken over everything, and you know, and all the GMO crops and all that BS, what is it that they don't already know? And the survey, even wants to, if you have a hobby farm, they want it reported if you got two chickens and a dog. And I always become leery when the government wants so much information about what seemingly is really not relevant in the scheme of things. If you're producing basically for your family and all this stuff, what interest would they have in what you're growing and doing other than, you know, your sanitary and all that stuff? But so I'm always suspicious. Of course, you know, when it comes to government, I don't trust them for a minute. Now, that's the truth. On any level, do I trust them? And so when you start seeking this kind of information, to this degree, I figured there's something else at work here, and I still believe that. And I believe years ago we were looking at when they first came out with this census, and they changed the word to census because it got challenged as a survey. You have no right to do this. So they tacked the word census on it because the in the Constitution, the government has a right to do a head count, a census, but it doesn't say anything about counting your corn cobs. When they're trying to gather this much in-depth information, I figure there's an ulterior motive, because they don't give that much of a damn about any of us out here. And so what could be the motive behind this? Go ahead.
That is something that I've spent a lot of time looking into. And there's actually a great article on this website called Civil Eats about what are called zero sales farms. And those are farms like the hobby farms you mentioned, where people may have, you know, a few chickens, or they maybe grow some food for themselves, or maybe they don't.
Yep.
But USDA counts them in the Census of Agriculture. So I was able to get data on how many farms there were in the census, and 22% in the 2002 census were zero sales farms. I'm trying to get the data for the 2017. The Census of Agriculture is every 5 years, and I haven't received it yet. But what data we do have indicates that it's probably even larger than 22% of the farms. So we're looking at almost a quarter of all farms in this census that aren't even selling agricultural products.
Right.
So why – and this is a new phenomenon, as you pointed out. 30 years ago – you know, there were about 8%, I think, 7 or 8% of the farms in the census were zero sales, didn't sell anything. So we're talking about almost a tripling of the share. So in talking to people about why this is, and it's something that I don't have a complete handle on, and there's no hard evidence, but a lot of people have pointed out that this is politically beneficial to the Department of Agriculture. Right. So you have a situation in which you have this massive department. It's a cabinet position that has its fingers in every county in the United States. They have an incredible amount of programs. But because, as we talked about, they were biased toward large scale capital intensive operations. And that's who they supported. We just saw this massive decrease in the farm population from the 40s up until today. And so now they went from being a department that worked had a daily impact on a large share of Americans' lives every day in the 40s to today. You know, there's the census reports about 2 million farmers. I think more realistically, there's about 1 or even 1.5 million at the most. So that's a very small share of Americans. And so the way one of the ways they may have dealt with this to protect their funding and to argue that they're still relevant is to make their definition or to count farms in a more inclusive way. If that makes sense.
Okay.
So every time they count a hobby farm that's not really producing anything for money or doesn't produce anything, that justifies their funding. And that helps justify their funding. And I should also say their funding has been under attack consistently for 30 years. I'm as critical of USDA as pretty much anyone, I think, but I do think there's also important services that they can provide families, and it's very difficult for them to do that, even though the farming population has decreased. But I still think we need to be clear about how many farms there are and to have a census of agriculture that people can trust.
Go ahead, Marty. You had a question?
Well, no. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Well, I wanted to get back to just in your findings and the research, and you talked to a lot of people in and outside of USDA. I would like to know the depth of the problem at USDA, and if, in fact, all the things that have been said about these previous administrations, president after president, Congress after Congress, it seems to me there's a credibility gap in terms of looking at the systemic problem at USDA. And the other question is, and when you ask these questions and you were getting to the systemic problem, and I'd like for you to describe on what your findings were, what was the reaction of Dr. Joe Leonard and Vilsack to the articles that you published, and maybe the response in terms of what you actually wrote in the articles based on your research and not the the research or the information that they furnish you?
So I would be happy to start, but you want to go ahead.
No, go
okay.
Ahead,
sure. Well, I'll just summarize it very briefly. And then we can maybe go, Bryce, if you want to talk about give your thoughts on it. But basically, the two reactions were Joe Leonard, he denied, and then when I presented him with data that contradicted his account, he lashed out at people. He lashed out, for example, in the story. This was all in the story. This was an on-the-record interview. I'm happy to share the recording with anyone that wants to hear it. He called Lloyd Wright, for example, and Lloyd Wright, Bryce mentioned him earlier. He's a pioneer at USDA. He was a leader there in the NRCS and the Conservation Service, and then he became the head of civil rights under Clinton before retiring. And he's widely respected and known for his amazing work when he was at the Conservation Service and the Civil Rights Department. He's widely respected both as an innovator and as an administrator and a public servant. Joe Leonard also believed that this whole narrative, that the data that we were presenting him with, he believed that was all coming from Lloyd Wright. I'm not quite sure why it wasn't true. Lloyd Wright was actually more focused on the structural issues at USDA than we actually didn't talk with him that much about Joe Leonard. But in any case, Joe Leonard was convinced that Lloyd Wright was giving us all these ideas, and he just ranted about him and said that, you know, he wasn't a professional. He was just a farmer. And because he was a farmer, he could say whatever he wants. But Joe Leonard was a professional, so he had to be careful in what he did and said. So Joe Leonard's reaction was just to lash out. And then he stopped talking to us eventually because there were, you know, all the data, all his claims regarding data, they just didn't add up. And when we would ask him, he would just give an excuse or give us another story. And then when we would point out that his data or his story didn't make sense, he just would get upset, and eventually he just stopped talking to us. Vilsack, on the other hand, his reaction was just to deny everything. There are no problems. He did a wonderful job. He had a wonderful employees that were committed to civil rights at USDA, and why are we bringing up all these little issues when he did so much for civil rights? I think that was his stance, and unlike Joe Leonard, he talked to us, or he exchanged, we had some exchanges after the article was published, and he said the same thing that he said from the very beginning, that he championed civil rights at USDA. But I encourage people to read our story and to read his responses to the allegations we brought up, and I think the evidence is pretty clear.
You know, and we, just adding to what Nate said, I mean, my opinion, again, from listening and reading the exchanges, is that Tom Vilsack just did not take this seriously. I mean, not only did he not take these issues seriously when he was at USDA, and you can find articles about how he said he was bored and not interested at the end of his term. I don't think he
was
all that interested in answering questions either. I mean, he was annoyed, you know, at times. And then I think the fact that he continued to message with Nate just tells you how little concern he had about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I think some of the things we found are unbelievable, completely unbelievable.
Yes.
That they happened. And, you know, I wanted to add to Nate was, just quick thing. Nate was saying he has the interviews. We are planning to, at some point, create an archive online that anyone will be able to access with lots of transcripts and audio so people can check this out, you know, for themselves if they are skeptical of the article, because, you know, I'm convinced, I'm a very cautious person. I'm convinced the evidence
mm-hmm.
is just completely overwhelming. What were you going to say, Nate?
I forgot what I was going to say, but yeah, the you know, Leonard and Vilsack said there were so many misleading statements and statements that just did not match reality or the data that we couldn't. Our article, as I've said, is a very long one. It's almost a short book, and we couldn't fit in everything, all the claims
right.
that they made that were just completely ludicrous. I'll give you one example that didn't make the article. They claimed that they increased the share of minority employees at USDA by 30-something percent. I think it was 34%, but I'm not 100% sure. When we checked USDA's own data, it wasn't anywhere close to that. And in fact, relative to the working population, USDA became less diverse during their term. But and this is something that they told Congress, they told reporters, they told public audiences of minority groups and advocacy organizations. And just that kind of, you know, call it a mistake, call it a lie, it was just a brazen untruth. And
right.
there are just
wow.
example after example of that.
Well, I kind of want to, Joe Leonard's biography here, I'm going to actually pull it up. He works for D.C. government. And Nate, help me if I don't get this correct, but okay, his website says, his bio says, well, during Dr. Leonard's tenure, there was a 50% decrease in farmer complaints nationwide. So when you hear that, you probably think, wow, every year, you know, looking each year from the start of his term, maybe there were 100 complaints, and by the end, 50% decrease, there were 50. That's not what he means when he says this, like, at least in the explanation he gave Nate. I believe what he means here is that when he came in, there were, like, complaints sitting there from the Bush administration. And the inventory is the term he used, I think, of complaints was huge,
yeah.
thousands and thousands. And by the end, the inventory had gone down by 50%. Does that any way match your common sense understanding of what complaints falling by 50% means? I mean, I don't think anyone would think that. But you cannot tell that that's what he means from the website. And I mean, that's so typical of the way that they interact with the public. And I just don't think that's right.
And I think,
wow. And that, I just want to say, too, that 50% number is completely made up.
Right.
It was originally 90% on the website, and I asked him where he got that from, where the data was, and he said, originally he didn't respond, and then I showed him the data again, and I said, this is clearly incorrect, and he said, oh, someone in my staff gave me that number,
right.
You know, I didn't, they gave me the wrong data. And he just changed it to 50 with that. And then I asked him for an explanation. And he changed the story, because when I originally spoke to him, he said, yeah, we saw like a 90% drop in the number of complaints. And he heavily implied, and he stated this to other journalist outlets too, he heavily implied that it was a drop, as Bryce said, in the number they were receiving. And then when I showed him the data, he said, oh no, as Bryce said, I was referring to the inventory. The problem with that as well is not only was he just, excuse my language, but bullshitting us, it was also that the reason the inventory went down was because they just threw out essentially the old complaints. They weren't able to do, they didn't do anything with the old complaints.
Oh, yeah.
And so taking credit for throwing out old complaints is just even if that number, if that share is accurate, which it's not, taking credit for throwing out those old complaints is just awful.
Yeah, that's another.
Did he ever talk about the processing of new complaints, or just the conversation only dealt with the backlog?
We discussed both, and he claimed that there was a decrease in the new complaints, and his claims about how many and what the share was, it kept changing. And that was one of the things, you know, they made so many claims that didn't stand up to scrutiny that we couldn't cover all of them. But
it got confusing,
they also claimed,
for us.
we were making diagrams to try to figure out what they were talking about. Mr. Leonard couldn't keep track. It's quite clear from our interviews with him that he was just so used to making claims that he didn't have to back up, that he wasn't even prepared to answer when we presented him with contrary evidence. But I'll give you one example of that. They both, Leonard and Vilsack, again, in documents that they sent to Congress, in official internal documents, and in public speaking, they both claimed that USDA was receiving the lowest number of discrimination complaints from farmers ever. Okay? And so there's a big problem with that, though, is that before the Vilsack administration, USDA wasn't counting the complaints they received. And so I asked them about this, right? So imagine if, the city you live in has a really high rate of people dying from cancer because of industrial waste. But they don't keep track of how many people are passing away from cancer due to the industrial waste. And then a new mayor comes in and they track the number of cancer, people with cancer in the city for the first time. And the mayor declares, we have the lowest rate of cancer ever. Congratulations. That is what
ever recorded.
Vilsack and Leonard did at USDA.
Yeah.
Well, based on that kind of administrative leadership, is in your research, and you've talked to both employees in and outside of the Office of Civil Rights as well as farmers, what problems are so specifically innate and germane to not only how they process the farmer complaints, but did you get the opportunity to get data as well as feedback that would question the way the Office of Civil Rights itself treated its own employees and how they treated how they treat employees throughout the department? What is your analysis or your feeling about your findings on that, if you have any?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's
a big part of the problem. I'm glad you brought that up because that is key to the systemic issues at USDA.
And what did you find in talking with many people in and outside. Did you find, what is your drift on how the office functioned within itself and how it treated its own employees and how they were processing employee complaints? What did you get any finding or any feeling about or come to any conclusion about if this problem is systemic or is it just related to farmers?
So I think that, so we've mentioned Lloyd Wright a few times. So Lloyd Wright was director of the office under Clinton, and he came back to USDA under Vilsack, and he referred to the Office of Civil Rights as a closing machine, and I think that completely sums it up. I think that based on, you know, the interviews that Nate did with current workers and then some of the interviews we did with former workers who no longer work in government, it became, in looking at statistics and reading about the history of the Civil Rights Office, I mean, this office has been a problem for many, many years. And it under, Joe Leonard and Tom Vilsack, its main function was to never pay out a complaint, try to disqualify a complaint before it even counted as a complaint, because then they wouldn't have to register that the complaint was made, and then publish misleading or doctored statistics to give the public the impression that things were improving. I mean, Nate already addressed the issues with the statistics, that they had no basis in fact. But I mean, heard horror stories from people in USDA from the way they've been mistreated for years and years, you know, the top management. And, you know, something we found that the top managers at the time, you know, like many of them were friends. They knew each other. They would like recruit people who would play ball from other agencies and kind of work together to kick complaints out. And then, you know, many of the level people are also mistreated by the same leadership, like harassed or subjected to retaliation if they tried to do their job properly. So, do you want to talk about that some, Nate?
Yeah. It's really, if you work in civil rights, there's a lot of good people in civil rights at USDA. And for the story, the first story we published in June, I interviewed over 16 people and talked. I officially interviewed that many and talk to even more. And the stories, you know, were remarkably similar, where there are people who worked in civil rights because they cared about equity and civil rights issues and they wanted to make a difference. And often they, you know, wanted to help black farmers, but they were in a system where if you did the right thing, you were systematically punished for doing it.
Right.
And so they're put in this catch-22 where it's either they go along and just go with the system and they're hurting other people, or they do the right thing and they get hurt by the department. And it's an impossible position to be in. And when you're put in that position, it can be also be hard to – a lot of people leave, but it can be hard to leave as well, was particularly when you have corrupt managers. And you know, these employees, they not only did they have similar accounts of what happened to them, but they also described, and many of them didn't know each other, but they described in great and very specific detail how USDA systematically covered up discrimination complaints and quashed them. And it's an open scandal.
Are you saying in so many words that USDA's numbers that they publish for the NOFIA report and the report to Congress, are you saying that those numbers on processing farmer complaints and investigations, as well as the ones dealing with employees. You don't think that, based on the information that and the documentation you've been able to gather, that those numbers were not true at all, that were being reported to the Congress and others?
They're manipulated in many different ways. And we focus in the story on the new food economy, we talk about how they manipulate and just often just make up numbers for farmers. We have one of our sources within USDA told us that the number of complaints that Joe claimed they received in 2011 was the same number of complaints they received just for the state of Alabama. There's some manipulating. There's also making up numbers. And with employee complaints, it's a little harder to just make them up. With the farmer complaints, they can ignore them. They can quash them in various ways. But they have to be a little trickier with the employee complaints. And I'll give you an example that I've heard from several people. Say there's a high-level manager at USDA who sexually harasses one of his employees. If they get wind that employee is going to file a harassment complaint, they will, the employee comes to report it, they will tell that employee that, or they will, sometimes I've heard they'll just shut the system down. The system is called iComplaints. But they can't input the complaint. Or they'll tell the employee, they'll try to persuade the employee not to file it, or they'll just make up that the complaint system is down. So there are various ways in which they either just make up or try to massage or manipulate the data to keep the numbers favorable. But they've been pretty successful with the program complaints, and they do the same thing with the employees, but they're also getting a lot of these complaints, the employee complaints, because they're overturned. So the employees can appeal to something called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And there's a backlog of cases in this appellate system, the EEOC, and it's by no means a perfect system. But they keep overturning USDA decisions when it comes to discrimination and harassment complaints at a rate higher than any other department in the federal government. So just think about that. I mean, we all know that the civil rights system in the federal government is broken, but the data are telling us that it's worse at USDA than any other department in the country.
I think that's easy to believe. And talking about how employees and farmers are treated, specifically getting back to a lot of the research you did on black farmers, where did you or how did you or did you see any difference in a disparity or proper compensating farmers based on settlements and based on their claims and what you heard from farmers? What is your take on the compensation to black farmers based on your research?
Nate can speak in more detail than me, but you can find a number of black farmers who say that they are, if we're talking about the Pickford settlement, which was the civil rights settlement that got going under Clinton, and then there was a second settlement, I don't know if I'm using exactly the right term, under the Obama administration, that paid out money to people who, black people who had been discriminated against by USDA, either when they were farmers or trying to farm. And you can find a number of black farmers who say they are worse off after that settlement for a number of reasons. But a huge one, which we talk about in the article, is that, you know, because farmers carry so much debt, a very important piece of this settlement was debt relief, and very few farmers ended up getting it. The most common payment was $50,000, which, again, many farmers said, and these are farmers who do not know each other, you know, or they might know each other, but they were not coordinating when they talked to us. They said it's not enough to buy a tractor. So they didn't get, you know, the relief that they needed from this case, even though they'd been discriminated against. So I think, Nate, do you want to add more to that?
Yeah, and I think that there are two important issues, and Bryce talked about how there's a lot of evidence that the farmers, the plaintiffs in Pinkford, didn't get restitution for sufficient restitution in many cases. And then there's the larger issue of the often, you know, when we talk to people who aren't familiar with these issues about Pinkford or black farmers, people ask, well, you know, weren't they compensated through Pinkford, which is the largest class action lawsuit in the United States history. So that's $2 billion that went to black families and black family or black farmers. Isn't that a lot of money? That's kind of the response. And so not only, as Bryce mentioned, did a lot of farmers not get anything, maybe even the majority of the farmers get anything close to what they would have lost during the period of the suit. But that $2 billion is nothing compared to the value of the profits in the land that black farmers lost as a result of discrimination. Bryce and I are on a team of researchers who's working to quantify the value of those lost profits and that lost land, which came from really incredibly brutal discrimination by USDA and other authorities. And conservatively, we're not done. We haven't published the working paper yet, but we can say that conservatively, hundreds of billions of dollars were lost as a result of discrimination. And so if you look at that $2 billion in the context of those hundreds of billions of dollars, even if, which probably it appears as if it wasn't the case that farmers were adequately compensated, but even if they were, it's still just a drop in the bucket.
Right. Right.
And
yeah.
And so, you know, this is also why increasingly there's a lot of talk and discussion about reparations. Right now, it's been something that a lot of Democratic primary candidates are being asked about. And this is also why, you know, the discussion about reparations can't just be about slavery or just what happened during the Jim Crow era or redlining. It also the discussion also needs to be about what happened to black land ownership, because farmland, it appears as if farmland was the largest single source of wealth for black families in the South up until the Civil Rights era.
Right, and these farmers who, you know, lost their – I'm trying to say that many farmers who lost their land are still alive, you know, and or maybe rather than say lost their land, had their land taken from them. And if someone takes your land from you, you know, you're entitled to have it back. So I think that should be part of – I think people should address that specifically. Politicians should address that specifically, because this is, like, a serious injustice. And, yeah, I mean, I think that – I hope that – politicians who care about these issues talk with black farmers about this, because they can help them, you know, solve these kind of problems?
Well, on that issue, there's a lot of discussion. Van Newkirk, who has been mm-hmm. talking about this issue, but in the big political sphere here, you have Elizabeth Warren indicating that she supports reparation, but I think she also talked about what she's going to do for black farmers. In your estimation, what do you think in the political arena, with all these individuals running for president, courting the black vote, what do you think someone like Elizabeth Warren, who has talked on the surface about things that she would do, are those things that she would like to do based on your reading are things that are going to be productive? And if not, what kind of recommendations do you have for political arena today? If people wanted to talk about that issue, what should they be talking about based on your research?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, it's good to see a candidate specifically talking about the concerns of black farmers. But unfortunately, you know, in our discussions with farmers themselves and advocates that work for them, the Warren plan, intentions aside, was counterproductive in some really or would be counterproductive if implemented for black farmers in some really important ways. And there are several things we're going to discuss, but I'm just going to focus on two real quick. One is that it doesn't get at the systemic issues in the civil rights office that we've discussed. You know, it doesn't matter how good your plan is, as long as the civil rights office at USDA is covering up discrimination rather than addressing it, we're going to continue to see disparities, and we're going to continue to see black farmers and other farmers suffer as a result. So, you know, and her recommendation for the office was just to fully fund it and to have audits and to report, to make their data reporting more transparent. And that's a problem when the office just makes up, as there's overwhelming evidence, that they just make up their data and they have become skilled at just following the necessary procedures to get good audits. Meanwhile, they're quashing complaints. You know, her plan doesn't address the problems at the civil rights office in any kind of meaningful way. So that needs to be the first. If a discrimination at USDA is going to be addressed, the first thing that needs to be done is the civil rights office really needs to be overhauled. And then two, the plan focuses on heirs' property, which basically it refers to property that is been passed on without a will, which is a major problem in black and some low-income communities in rural America. But her plan said that black land loss was a result of heirs' property. And then her recommendation, her proposals to help black farmers all focused on heirs' property. And there needs to be initiatives to address heirs' property, but the problems and the issues that black farmers are concerned with extend way beyond that. And you know, her plan didn't address those needs in any kind of serious way.
I think some of what Nate was saying connects back to the question you asked earlier, Lawrence, about the systematic nature of what's been happening at USDA, and something, you know, I wanted to say was, I think if you look at the history of civil rights in USDA, and me and Nate have talked about this a lot, you see this pattern where a new administration comes in and they say they're going to fix civil rights, and they do audits or they do reports, and sometimes the audits and reports actually do find kind of amazing things, like this one report, I think it's from GAO, talks about USDA kicking the GAO agents out of the building because they were asking questions that they didn't want them to ask.
I remember that.
Yeah. And, you know, in the crit and crat reports, there's some very emotional, intense stories, you know, from black farmers. And nevertheless, despite this documentation, things don't really seem to change in the office. In fact, sometimes it seems like they get worse. And I think that the Warren plan, it's kind of symptomatic of something we've also been talking about tonight, which is the way that, like, the press has interacted with USDA, or, you know, people left of center have involved, who are involved in politics, have interacted with USDA, which is to say that they may be well-meaning, but their understanding of kind of the dynamics happening at the department is way divorced from reality. You know, which isn't to put personal blame on anyone, but I think if they really want to reform the Civil Rights Office, they need to look a bit deeper at what's going on, and they can you know, try to talk to people who are there or used to be there. And then likewise with Ayers Property. I mean, the thing with Ayers Property is that I think kind of bothered me in the plan. You know, like Nate said, it's a huge problem. But to treat it in isolation of all the other difficulties that black farmers have faced is not sufficient. You know, so there have been a number of really excellent articles about the problems with Ayers Property. And I'm not an expert, but as far as I understand, the solutions people are coming up with seem very good. And I believe there's a bipartisan consensus to do something about this in some states. But I think treating it in isolation sidesteps kind of the question about how did this problem get so bad in the first place, or ignores other issues that black farmers face, like discrimination from USDA. And I think that's what was maybe disappointing in the Warren plan. So, yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of my reaction to it.
Do you think that maybe some of the problems... Okay, go ahead, Lawrence.
No, go ahead, Marty. Go ahead.
Do you think maybe some of the problems in this is the fact that the people that are overseeing this or supposed to oversee it have absolutely no knowledge of what they're talking about?
I think that you see, like, in the press and then with, you know, political campaigns too, that, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of complicated reasons. And I think if I hadn't worked with Nate, I would really have no idea. You know, I would not know any better. I would think, you know, I'd probably be impressed by the Warren plan.
Right.
But I think knowing more, and it is hard to learn more. I mean, it takes a lot of work, and you have to kind of ask, you have to talk to people who the press doesn't usually talk to, and it just takes a very long time to figure out what's going on. So in that respect, I do understand why they came up with the solutions they did, because they are to find. They're like lower hanging fruit. I mean, that's not exactly the term I want to use. It's easier to come up with them.
Yeah.
And
well, the thing that... Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And right, and I just think I would like to see people dig a bit deeper and ask more questions before they propose the next round of solutions.
One of the things I've noticed over these years, and it's been many, many years that I've dealt with various politicians on various issues, and the thing is they don't write any of the bills themselves. Somebody else does that.
Right.
I would love to have this job. I really would, because virtually you don't do anything. A bill writer does it. You know what I'm saying? They hand them the bill, they sponsor it, or they add a word or two there and then say they authored it. And then when you question them about it, they seem to know little to nothing about what's going on. And to me, that is a huge, huge problem in this, is that the people that are writing the laws, supposedly making the regulations, either don't know anything at all about it and have no intentions of learning, because somebody from a lobbyist or whomever told them what they need to know, or you have people who are in the agency who become very protective of the agency and will just do what they're told, even though they know they're telling you a lie. Like you say, you talked about Joe Leonard, catching him repeatedly, giving you misinformation, which is a nice way of saying he was lying to you. But this is what I've encountered all through these years, is that these politicians, the people that do the voting, the people that bring out the bills, actually don't know squat. They don't know anything. They can't answer any questions because they never bothered to find out what they're talking about. And they just want their name on the bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, and in agriculture, I think it's quite possibly even worse than that. You have a small number of legislators who have staffers that care about agriculture. But particularly on the Democratic side or on the left, there just aren't that many people that they can go to that have expertise in these areas. The Democrats have a very shallow bench in agriculture when it comes to it. The think tanks generally ignore agriculture. Any of the policy shops that have any kind of resources generally ignore it. There are some wonderful advocacy organizations that do great work, but they're swimming against the current.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Marty. I want him to finish answering your question.
Well, this was just one of the things. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Okay.
We can hear you, Marty. We can hear you.
One of the things that has bothered me over the years is the idea that these people making these decisions, putting out these reports, speaking to the media and everything else, have no real working knowledge at all of what they're talking. You've got people voting on the farm bill that couldn't tell you, you couldn't identify a farm if they were sitting in the driveway. And they're voting on this, and it's basically what they're voting on is funding, where the money's going to go. And what happens to that money once it gets there, it's like, what the hell? And I don't know how we get past this. We've got an agency that on numerous levels is dysfunctional, mismanaged, in many cases guilty of fraud, discrimination, manipulation of reports, all kinds of things. And yet this thing still is running. We're still being forced to fund it. I have a problem with that. I just don't.
Nate, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's criminal. Lives, careers, farms, they're all at stake. These are very serious issues, and they deserve attention, and they deserve real public debate and attention, and we're not getting that. There's a failure on multiple levels. The media is failing us. Our political leaders are failing us. And it's going to take a lot of work in organizing to turn that around.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, not only that, we only have about 6 minutes left. To add to the failure, Miles Edwards just finished part one through four of a documentary that talks about USDA and the last plantation. And he calls out in that documentary, he calls out and talks about or mentions some of the organizations and leaders that have turned their backs on black farmers. And he states very clearly that's one of the reasons why black farmers have suffered. Before you leave, I don't know if we have enough time. I've got 5 minutes. Can you talk, when we talk about losses, how, and is there anything that you can say with reference to how the tariffs have impacted black farmers and the money that's coming from the government? Has that also reached black farmers, Nate and Bryce?
Do you want to take that one, Nate?
Sure. Yeah. So, Bryce and I submitted a Freedom of Information Act to USDA, and with the data that we got back, it showed that 99.4% of all the bailout payments went to white landowners and farmers. So we're talking about over $8 billion, and almost all of that went to relatively wealthy or relatively wealthy landowners and farmers. And so that is just – and that is in large part, you know, the result of the land loss and dispossession of black and other minority farmers that we talked about earlier. And but it's a continual exacerbation of this inequality, because – that, you know, I think black people received, 0.2% of the funds. Well, if they were given an equal chance to own farmland and farm in this country, and their share of the farmland and the agricultural industry reflected their share of the population, they would have received about 14% of that money. So this is hundred and the bailout payments are about to be expanded, and we might see $12 billion additional dollars over the next year go to 99.5% white farmers. So we're talking about hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that are essentially not going to non-white people because they weren't given and still aren't given the same opportunities as white families.
Jesus. I still always have such a problem. This goes back to, I've been involved in civil rights since I was a young woman, which was many moons ago. That we're still encountering these problems. Lawrence said one time when I questioned him about it, how can this be going on? It's hard to believe it's going on. And he said, oh, it's still going on, Marty. They've just become more sophisticated. And that's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
The discrimination mm-hmm. is just more sophisticated. We've got 90 seconds left here. I want to thank you both for coming back on again and discussing this. And I still want to see your documentary when you're ready. And what is there anything coming up in the future we should know about?
Well, we know that there's another part of Miles Edwards' documentary. There is another documentary that's being worked on by Sean Hill and Wayman Henderson, and their documentary will be coming out in November for one of Gary Grant's a program that he's having, his summit, his conference, and they plan to introduce that at that time. So there are a lot of things out there that's coming, and hopefully we'll get some more articles about the inner workings of USDA from many of the people that are doing investigations. So we are expecting much more information to come out talking specifically about the abuse and discrimination against farmers, as well as women employees and the sexual abuse that's been going on for decades.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Nate and Bryce, thank you for joining us again tonight. Lawrence, thank you for co-hosting. Thank you to all of our listeners, and we'll be back again next week with TS Radio and the USDA Hour. Good night, everyone.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks, Bryce.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.